So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to World Championship Wrestling. On behalf of WTBS, it's a pleasure to welcome the World Wrestling Federation. Exciting new matches, great competitors from all over the world. And here's the man to tell you all about it. Here's Vince McMahon. Vince?
Thank you very much, Freddie.
Welcome aboard.
Thank you. It is indeed a pleasure to be associated with WTBS, and we promise to bring you the greatest in professional wrestling entertainment in the world today. We will have this week, as a matter of fact, exclusive footage on a matchup involving the Iron Sheik, who hails from Tehran, Iran. Also on hand, Adrian Adonis and his tag team partner, Dick Murdoch, the reigning World Wrestling Federation tag team champions, will be with us. And then from there, a man who claims to have the most impressive physique in all of professional wrestling, Jesse the Body Ventura. And then from there, speaking of impressive, we shall have all 6 feet 10 inches of giant-like Big John Studd, who tips the scales very close to the 364-pound mark. Plus, special interviews on Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff and a great deal more. So we'll be right back as we will open up with our very first matchup involving the tag team champions in a moment.
Take two. Welcome to Review Away. I'm John Pollock, joined by Wei Ting.
I'm here.
Are you excited to review the good old days, Wei?
Oh, man.
Not our first redo.
No. It is our first time redoing it after, I don't know, I'd say it's been almost, what, 5 days?
Yeah, last week we did our review.
Oh, God.
Wei still doesn't want to relive it.
I don't want to think about that again.
I wasn't as mad about this one. I was mad, believe me. But, like, I just...
Well, for people who don't know what happened, let's just explain.
Well, we were in the different studio, and it was so confusing for me, first of all, because when we were doing Impact, I'm remembering stuff we said in the show, and I couldn't remember. It's like, I feel like I'm retelling a story at times, because...
Not everybody listens to all of our shows.
Yeah, some skip. Skip to where the wrestling starts. Makes sense?
Yeah, or just don't listen.
Yeah, some don't listen at all. Anyway, we go into this new studio because this one was having its problems.
Is this fixed now?
It's mainly fixed. People listening to this will have absolutely no clue of any issues, I don't believe. But it's minor. Minor in comparison, let's just say that way. This is this is the better of two evils. So we go into this other studio thinking, there's no problems in this studio, we'll just record. And we had to use a different editing program to record in. Did our checks. Everything seemed fine. We even played it back. Sounds fine. Sounded good, right?
We recorded a test, yeah, and we played it back. And then we went ahead and recorded our whole show for an hour and 15 minutes.
And what brings a tear to my eyes, Wei, was the fact that I said, that was a really good review, Wei. I think we really tackled that NWA history, like, pretty damn well.
I was really happy.
I was extremely happy because it's a time period that not everyone is familiar with. We're a generation removed from the NWA.
Yeah.
I thought we did some really good research on it. I just thought it was a really fun show. Yeah. And now that it's lost, it's going to become even greater in my mind.
Yeah. It was the show that is lost forever. That was perhaps our...
We will never hit the level today that we hit last week.
It was definitely one of our best shows of all time.
Maybe the best.
The best, yes. Even the banter. I mean, I went on a rant on iOS 7, how it's completely slowed down my phone. You had that great line about the Kentucky Derby that I don't think we'll ever...
The Kentucky Derby?
Yeah.
I don't even remember this.
I'm just making stuff up now.
Oh, okay.
But,
you had me fooled there.
Stuff of that caliber that, would have been really good. Now it's gone forever.
My big regret is that I wish it had happened this week. And if we had missed a show this week, I would have posted a photo up of you and me laid out and like a fist that has laid us out and we're giving the consumer nothing.
Yes.
As the payoff.
Yes. Sure.
Though we don't charge $55 for our podcasts and then not do one.
The time is worth, I'd say, $55.
Yeah.
I mean, let's be honest here. How many people complaining about that pay-per-view last night or 3 days ago paid for it? All these people complaining. You didn't pay for shit. Come on.
I think,
most of you.
one of our callers, Hanzi, on Sunday, he maintained he paid for that pay-per-view and he liked it.
Oh, okay.
Hated it. Just hated it.
I don't blame you.
I feel, though, I'm in my recovery stage now. I think I got everything out between The Law, Review of Raw, and my favorite chat ever with Jimmy Corderas.
Oh, man.
Where I just yelled.
Pollock was just, you know, it's not rare to see Pollock go off on things that he doesn't like in radio form. But I find that, you know, when you're on TV, you tend to maybe be a little bit more composed. I don't know if it's just simply the environment. Not today, though. Not to, 2 days ago in the chat with the review with Jimmy Corderas, which you can find at youtube.com/fightnetwork.
Go listen to my rant.
The Fight Network, I mean. Yeah, and Pollock just goes off. You cussed, man. You said a bad word on TV.
I didn't.
Big no.
I had nowhere to end this rant that I just made up in my head. And that seemed to me the most appropriate way to end
it. It actually was. It was the perfect way to end.
So there you go. I enjoyed it. You, Wei?
Yeah.
I sometimes I'm jealous of you, Wei.
Why?
Because I feel you've got your head on right.
Where? Yeah. What way?
You can look at Battleground. This show's going to suck. And you didn't put yourself through it.
You know, sometimes, though, that's, you know, sometimes these shows that don't look good on paper end up being great in the ring. And that wasn't the case. But that Rhodes match.
Did you see the Rhodes match?
I did see that, yeah.
Like, that was excellent. Yeah. Those 20 minutes, you're not going to hear one negative thing about me about any of that. I just thought it was 20 minutes of everything I love about wrestling. It was, you know, you could have made this for all the people that argue about that main event finish that, you know, we're just trying to tell a story and it's a turn in the road. You know what would have been a swerve that people wouldn't have seen coming was like Cody low blowing Goldust and joining the Shield or something like that. But you know what? They avoided the easy turn that other bookers would have just jumped at when we got the fans that invested. But instead they did what was predictable, what people wanted, and it was a great moment. I love that match. In fact, at the end of the night, had we not got that shitty finish, I couldn't have given that show less than a thumbs in the middle. Because even everything thrown out, it was like, how can I give a thumbs down to something that featured that show? But they found a way for me to give that show a thumbs down. So congratulations. They did outdo what I thought even they could muster.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Wei, we are going to go back in time today to a more simpler time when the dusty finish was just becoming a thing,
mm-hmm.
and when the wrestling world was much, much different.
So now you're doing this review after interviewing the director of this.
Michael Elliott, yes. He was our guest with myself and Court Bauer last week. For some of you that maybe heard the interview or not, you can go download it. It's at liveaudiowrestling.com on last week's Bauer and Pollock show. I might actually just tack it on to this one. Why not?
The whole thing?
It's 10 minutes.
Oh, okay.
A nice, easy
sure.
Watch. But let's just talk about kind of overall way. You know, you and I were not old enough to be watching the NWA during this specific time period.
Yeah.
I mean, when Ted Turner bought this fledgling company at the time in 1988, you and I were 4 years old. So we were not watching the NWA.
Mm-hmm.
And you grew up probably familiar with a more known NWA than this one.
Oh,
as my coolest friend I know.
No, I wouldn't say so. I wouldn't say I was listening to rap at that time. You know.
When did you first get into rap?
Oh, probably like in the
Early teens?
Mid to late 90s. Yeah. Yeah. Somewhere around the early.
Now, who were your favorites that you first clung to?
I used to love, like, I mean, who you didn't like, you know, Bad Boy and Puff Daddy and Mace and, of course, Biggie. But then I really gravitated towards Master P and the No Limit Soldiers.
And then he lost all his credibility in 1999.
Oh, he lost it way before that.
Yeah.
But,
that
yeah,
didn't pull that you in to, like, check out Master P?
No.
That wasn't a big deal of your worlds colliding at the time?
No, he kind of exploded like in like around 97, 98, and then that just, the whole thing tanked.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is the other NWA. What were you expecting from this documentary? Because you came in with kind of a clean slate.
That's right. I didn't really know much about the NWA outside of, you know, of course, what it eventually became in WCW. But everything prior to that, you know, 92 period, I was quite unfamiliar with. And so I found, I mean, I was expecting a bit of an introduction to it. Let's just, you know, for me, I'll just go ahead and say it. I was a little lost at parts, especially towards the beginning of this documentary, because I found it more geared towards somebody who already has a prior existing knowledge of a lot of this stuff. I mean, I found that the way they kind of started the documentary off, simply, like, without much fanfare, without many, you know, of the techniques you'd see on other documentaries, like a little montage to explain, like, a general story, there really wasn't anything like that. It just starts off, here's Jim Crockett Sr., this is what he used to do, and then, you know, a very linear way of storytelling. And a lot of the characters I had really not heard of before, and so I was a little bit lost. So it wasn't really until the mid part of the documentary when they got into the, you know, the steamboats and the flares, and eventually up until, you know, the demise of the promotion, that I really started to follow it and got a better sense of what this was.
Yeah, and I kind of like the fact that, you know, for people sitting down, of course you're going to have your fan base that grew up and this was their home territory that they followed, and they just want to know every nugget of information. But I think it was smart to, you know, the majority of the documentary is spent on what would be considered, you know, the big years. And they did tremendous business in the late 70s, but it was really that 80s run, right up until around 87 or so, when business kind of tailed off in at that period during the WWF expansion. Though it was like the NWA and the WWF, they were going head to head from 83 to 86 into 87. At that time period, it was a real wrestling war at the time. And, you know, it was funny because last week on Raw, they had that Triple H, Dusty Rhodes exchange talking about, you know, you were part of, you know, you were just a star in Florida and that NWA thing. And then when you tried to go national with us, you couldn't make it happen. Yeah. And it was just, you know, a complete kind of revision of history, because not only was the NWA the National Wrestling Alliance, it was a massively successful company, and they were able to go into a lot of the WWF's backyard markets in the Northeast and draw extremely well.
Can you explain to me, I'm still a little confused about the, you know, the names of the things. Okay, so you have the NWA, which is basically the governing body of all the territories that were a part of it. Am I correct?
Yeah, it was, you know, this particular territory, it was, you know, it was like the Mid-Atlantic territory, which comprised of, you know, the Carolinas and Virginia. Those were kind of like your chief operating cities that you were, or states that you were running at the time. And the NWA from there, as it grew into a national product, it was because of they were able to, you know, they were on the Superstation. They had that Saturday night time slot, so they could go across the country. Mm-hmm. And in the 80s, it became that Saturday night 6:05 time slot for the NWA. And
that was the Mid-Atlantic time slot at 6:05.
Yeah, right? It started out, yeah, where it was like Mid-Atlantic was in that slot.
And up until they were turned into WCW, what were the still existing territories within the NWA, or is it simply this?
I mean, there were still numerous territories that were tied to the NWA, but at that time, when you're getting to the late 80s, a lot of them were dying off at that time. And the name change was because the name of the television show, it was called World Championship Wrestling, and they just simply rebranded it when Ted Turner bought it and just turned World Championship Wrestling eventually later on after the buyout into that became the name of the promotion afterwards.
Okay.
In terms of just the aesthetics of this documentary, of course, all that footage, you know, the WWF owns, so you're kind of limited with what you can use, but they got extremely lucky here by being able to they were able to find somebody on a message board on the Mid-Atlantic Gateway site who had all these, like, old, I think just fan cam, like, footage of some extremely rare matches, including, you know, Flair and Steamboat's matches from the 70s, which were many were thought to be lost at this point. And I thought they just struck a gold mine here in terms of finding this footage and being able to do a lengthy documentary, not rely on some stock clips. I was very impressed with what they were able to gather here.
Yeah, definitely. They got very lucky with the footage owned by this man named George Pantis, who offered everything, and that stuff is bought by the WWE.
The WWE, right, I guess, having seen this documentary, has reached out. The deal was already in place here with this company to put the documentary together. But yeah, the WWE has now bought that footage, right, now that they know it existed.
Yeah, and definitely added a lot to this documentary. I mean, just try to imagine this whole story being told using only photos or talking heads. It would be a lot more harder to watch throughout the entire thing. But I thought, you know, they made good use of what they had. No sound, unfortunately, though.
Yeah, I mean, the documentary did have its limitations. This was all funded through Kickstarter. You know, it's difficult. It's
I don't know if it was just simply a sound that was not captured.
On the direct footage. Yeah, I'm imagining, yeah, they just didn't capture audio with whatever it was shot with, and you were kind of limited in that regard. The beginning, as Wei mentioned, it does focus on Jim Crockett Sr., who was the father of Jim Crockett Jr., David Crockett, and Jackie Crockett, all three of whom were interviewed for this project. But explaining that Jim Crockett Sr., he was a very well-respected promoter, and wrestling wasn't his be-all and end-all. It was him and his family. They promoted minor league baseball, other concerts, different entertainment acts when the circus came to town, all of that kind of stuff. And they were situated in a part of the country, Wei, where you didn't have, you know, tons of options for major league entertainment. And a lot of people looked at the fact the NWA, they were really able to flourish in that area because, you know, you weren't competing with, it's not like there was a major league baseball team in North Carolina or, you know, other major events going on. You were in a pocket where the NWA and wrestling, that was your major league entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
So they talk about him. Everyone here, just positive things to say. Even Ole Anderson, who is not easy to throw out the compliments.
Yeah, one of the great things about, you know, these non-WWE-produced documentaries is that not only do might you get a documentary that's free of their agenda and whatever they want to tell, but you also get to hear from a lot of voices that, you know, well, you'll never get to hear on a WWE-produced DVD.
And I liked, especially later in the documentary when they're talking about the fall of the company in 88, was, you know, you had all different opinions on what caused the fall. And you had some people, you know, you weren't just trying to, you know, stick to one narrative that, you know, Dusty booked this thing in the ground or the spending was out of control. You had just contrasting viewpoints from people that were there and just their own perspective. And they weren't trying to answer any, you know, generation old questions. It was just, here are the opinions. They're mixed and getting different points of view. I think that always strengthens a piece. And then the viewer is left to draw their own conclusions based on the facts that have been presented to them.
Yeah.
So that is always nice. Crockett Sr. had an interesting philosophy. He talked about the fact that he never, not Crockett Sr., but they spoke of him, that he never wanted to flaunt his money and he would never drive a car that was fancier than what the fans drove, because he never wanted to give that perception, which is a departure from a lot of bookers. You know, Jerry Jarrett having his massive house in Tennessee, or even later in this documentary, Dusty Rhodes talking about all the big cars the guys drove. And Crockett Sr. just always felt that, you know, you never want to, you know, give off this impression that you're taking home all the money, and the wrestlers then start to question why they aren't getting more money.
Mm.
So, an interesting factor.
How do you feel when you see our boss drive away in a nicer car than you?
I feel, to be fair, I've never seen our boss drive away in a car.
If he did have a nicer car than your Nissan Sentra.
Well, then maybe I'd have to start looking at other territories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Whatever. I mean, it doesn't bother me. I mean, you're the boss for a reason.
Well, the other argument is, you know, for the wrestlers especially, is that the other idea is you want to project being a big star. You don't want to blend in with your audience. I mean, for the talent's point of view, I do definitely get that. The idea that, you know, you have a dress code, or you want to present yourself as larger than life.
Yeah.
As Jimmy Hart's all old things like, baby, you start dressing like the audience, soon you'll be one. Anyway, they talked about just the evolution of the territory. It was very much a tag team territory for a long time. And they talked about when George Becker was the booker, Johnny Weaver, who was an area star for years and years. The Scott brothers, Skull Murphy and Brute Bernard, Rip Hawk and Sweet Hansen, and then different feuds they had over the years. And then the Anderson brothers came in, and originally it was Gene Anderson who was paired with Lars, and then eventually Ole came in when Lars left, and it was the Anderson brothers tag team that they were pretty much concentrated in the Mid-Atlantic territory and Georgia Championship Wrestling, which were their two big territories during their careers, and they drew tremendously well. Crockett Sr. died in April of 1973. It was very unexpected. And that's when it caused kind of this break in the lineage of the Crocketts running this territory, because Jim Crockett Sr. left the territory to a man by the name of John Ringley, who was married to his daughter. And instead of leaving it to his sons, he left it to this guy Ringley, who, you know, the Crockett sons assumed they their father didn't want them trapped within this business, but in a roundabout way, it would shortly end up with the Crocketts running the business when John Ringley, I guess, got
it. Wasn't he also more of the guy who took over, who oversaw most of the, like, had the most experience in running a company?
It seemed that way at the time, because
he was in charge of, like, the concerts and all that stuff.
He was working, I think, alongside the family at the time, so he was obviously very trusted, but apparently, you know, cheated on the Crockett sister, and then he was booted out. And this led, George Scott had come into book here while Ringley was in charge. And then when Ringley was kicked out, Jim Crockett Jr., he would assume the role of running the company. And then Jackie Crockett was a cameraman, and David Crockett was used as a producer and did all of the on-air, the interviews. So, and that set up the second generation of Crocketts.
It would be almost like Hunter cheating on Stephanie and getting booted out.
It would be exactly like that. Exactly. The current John Ringley, Triple H.
Yep.
Yeah. It was during this time with George Scott booking that they kind of got away from just booking it as a tag team territory into bringing in a lot of, you know, really some young upcoming talent like Ricky Steamboat and Ric Flair in the 70s, but also Wahoo McDaniel, very established at that time, and Johnny Valentine, who so many of the wrestlers talked about. He was so much needed in this territory that he brought a sense of realism to it and was just someone that just really was a big change in just the style of the territory. So that was kind of the changes it was going through, and they had a ton of success in the mid to late 70s.
Yeah. It's really difficult to think about a promotion that only promoted tag team wrestling and compare that to today when it's almost the complete opposite.
Yeah, it was very different. It wasn't, you know, like, that was really the calling card of the Carolinas during that time period before they shifted over. And, you know, from just an economic standpoint, it would somewhat handicap some of these promoters, because you're still getting the same amount of matches, but you're paying four guys instead of two. And right. That's something even currently in the WWE you hear stories of, where it's like, you know, you're putting all these guys on the road, cheaper to just throw out, you know, singles matches than putting, you know, two guys with a manager as a tag team on the road.
It sounds just like the Wu-Tang Clan, because I was actually, they're planning some type of tour in Toronto, one Toronto being one of the cities, and I think there's been a lot of debate about whether or not the show's even happening. It's been postponed a number of times, and I think part of the holdup is the fact that these guys, every one of these Wu-Tang Clan members, they are demanding to be paid as if they were appearing solo by themselves. But if you're the promoter, all you're getting is, you know, a 3-hour show with 10 guys, but you'd have to pay each of those 10 guys their individual, you know, fee, whatever they would make as a solo act.
Yeah, and if you bring in five of them, are you going to probably sell the same amount of tickets as if you brought in 10? Is it something special to have all 10?
It really is, yes.
Oh, okay.
But
if 9 were there, would you not go versus 10? You
I would still go. My cutoff would probably be, you know, to be honest with you, if it was 3, I'd go, because I'm just that big of a fan. But you can't really sell it as the Wu-Tang Clan.
It's too bad. We used to work with a guy who I'm sure could have got you in for free.
Yeah.
For a secret gig.
Yes. Or just get me turned away at the door.
Yeah, Wei Ting was unfortunately sold a bag of goods where he thought he was going to get to watch Wu-Tang for free, and then was turned away.
Yeah.
Really? That was battleground booking right there.
Yeah.
We should talk about the plane crash. October the 4th, 1975, involved Tim, Mr. Wrestling Woods, Bob Bruggers, Johnny Valentine, Ric Flair, and David Crockett, and they were flying from Wilmington to Charlotte, North Carolina. They were on this two-engine plane, and this is, of course, the famous plane crash where it went down, Ric Flair broke his back, Johnny Valentine's career ended, Bob Bruggers actually died, and Tim Woods was on this plane with heels at the time, and he forced himself to come back to work right away because if it was acknowledged he was injured and on this plane with the heels, you know, Ric Flair said this guy saved our business because he didn't let the kayfabe die.
He could have killed himself.
Can you imagine that? 1975. Imagine if that happened today and Zack Ryder forced himself to work Raw next week because it can't come out that he was on a plane with Jack Swagger and Antonio Cesaro.
It's so silly to consider now that anybody would go to that length to stay in character, you know, at the risk of their own health. I mean, I think it just, for me, it's just hard to comprehend that kayfabe meant that much to, you know, your company's bottom line at that time.
Yeah, it was a different time. Like, they would argue a better time in terms of, you know, being able to sell these people to the public and people having faith in this product. And they lived and died by this.
What if it came out today that, you know, like baseball was staged and all these guys actually within baseball were just, I don't know, playing characters. These balls might have been magnetic.
You know, you joke about that, but it's, I mean, look at the UFC and how many fights are put together where, you know, we've met enough of these guys and you know that, you know, they will full out just create these conflicts with one another. And then bury the hatchet right after a fight. Yeah. It's like, are we that far away from, you know, how much different is that versus pro wrestling of the 70s?
That's
where people believe in all of these when they watch this.
It's very different, though. There are similarities. Of course, you look at, you know, like Chael and Vanderlei right now. I have no doubt that these guys, they both know what they're doing. They both want to make as much money as they want. Do they really want to kill each other or hate each other's guts? I don't think so. They're in business.
And you don't think so, but there's an audience out there who, what is their reaction? They're thinking, is this real?
Yeah, exactly.
And that's exactly how people were in the 70s watching wrestling.
Differences though, John, when they're actually fighting, I don't doubt for a second that they're actually throwing real punches.
No, I'm not suggesting it's a worked fight. I'm saying, though,
I don't mind rivalries being fake as long as you're giving me a real fight afterwards. I mean, all they're doing is creating interest.
But the key is there is a believability to these grudges in mixed martial arts where, you know, there are people that even the ones that say, ah, this is bullshit, there's still that part of them that isn't sure, that isn't quite aware if this is just all an act. Are these people really, do they really hate each other? Yeah. And it's like, that is the kind of mentality you had in your pro wrestling audience back when the product was accepted a lot easier and people spent a lot more money in all the different territories that were running at the time versus today.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, so the plane crash there, that was also the story. They were able, we should mention here, so many different people interviewed on this, and because they were in a partnership with High Spots, had an access to their archive with two of the key interviews to me being a Dusty Rhodes interview they had that looked to be shot in someone's kitchen as they were sitting on a floor looking up at Dusty's chin, and then Ric Flair, the infamous like 8-hour shoot interview he did with High Spots that resulted in a lawsuit. But Ric Flair, he was, you know, very much a key talking head in this documentary, talking about this plane crash. And I mean, he was the guy you want to have on a documentary like this.
Like, think about the amount of content, you know, so a site like High Spot or a place like High Spots has, or like an art video has, of just all the footage they have of people talking about topics like these. And think about the potential for a documentaries to be made using all that.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's a great kind of side business to have going, is like, if you just stock up on some of these interviews and then these documentaries come about and you can license out your footage.
Yeah.
We're sitting on a ton of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it would need to be cataloged. Yeah. You know,
the never before seen Cauliflower Alley interviews from 2006. Remember those?
Not really.
Gary Hart, Harley Race, Oliver Humperdinck. God, we did like six of them in Las Vegas.
I actually wasn't there. It was you and Mouth.
Yeah. Nick Bockwinkel we interviewed. I'm trying to remember them all.
Steamboat and Flair.
They talked about this feud and just the rare footage. I mean, it wasn't whole matches or anything captured, but you had just in clip form, it just looked like these two were just at just such an incredible chemistry the two had together. And Ric Flair has always stated that as good as their 89 stuff was, had they seen their matches in the 70s where they were working every single night together.
Much younger as well.
Yeah. I mean, like Flair was 40 in 89. Mm-hmm. And here he was, you know, back in the mid 70s at this point and coming off a broken back at the time, no less. He's always looked at this was their best matches were the ones that probably a lot of people have not seen. So it was cool just even in clip form to see these two.
And these two just always seem to be such a natural pairing with each other. First of all, both guys obviously two of the best workers ever. But I mean, just their look, you know, both guys very well built. One has black hair, one has white hair. One is very humble. The other's ultra cocky. So, great stuff. Great to see this old footage.
George Scott eventually left in the early 80s, and he left for the WWF. And it was when Ole then came in. He was booking Georgia Championship Wrestling at the time and took on the responsibility of also booking Mid-Atlantic at the time. And this was at a time when they had kind of broken up the territories where you had kind of Gary Hart was based, running North Carolina, Wahoo doing Virginia, and then Dory Funk Jr. In South Carolina. So Ole came in, and they spent some time here. Just, like, unbelievable how you could imagine what this guy and his work schedule was like, booking two full-time territories and working at the same time on top of this. And he pretty much acknowledges it was a major regret of his taking on all of this because he was just burnt out at the time.
You can say that you're pretty much the Ole Anderson of radio.
Oh, I don't know about that. Booking two territories and working.
You're doing like five shows. You're doing a.
Most people, if Russia, you say you're the Ole Anderson of blank, you're pretty much telling me I'm an asshole.
That's not what I meant.
I heard our own Braden Harrington shared a story about someone coming up to him at the Hammertown Comic Con, stating, "All right. Is Agnew really the heel? Because I think Pollock is the actual heel."
Oh, I don't remember that.
Oh, you didn't hear this story?
Yeah.
Well, it was Braden shared it on our new What's Next podcast that you can all listen to on liveaudiowrestling.com.
What's Next. I love that name.
Minus the vowels.
Yep.
Very clever name. So, with Ole coming in, this was where they started building towards the first Starrcade in 1983, and it was really based around, you know, two key things. First, you had Ric Flair chasing for his second NWA title that Harley Race held, and then as well, you had this incredibly hot feud with Sergeant Slaughter and Don Kernodal against Ricky Steamboat and Jay Youngblood, who are just an incredibly underrated tag team in wrestling's history. And they had sold out the Greensboro Coliseum with that tag match, and that was the precursor to Starrcade. And at this point, Dusty Rhodes was also brought in, and he would be one of the most influential people in the history of this territory. But Starrcade really was that first super mega card where everything at the prior had been, you know, really based on closed circuit, and this was building up to a big event, and it would predate WrestleMania, which would come around just over a year after the first Starrcade event in November 1983.
And do you think Vince was influenced by Starrcade?
It's hard to say he wasn't. I mean, this was clearly where wrestling was gearing itself towards, and with pay-per-view just becoming something that was a viable revenue stream for pro wrestling, and it was one of the few outlets that could make money off of pay-per-view. I mean, boxing and wrestling are the two that have been able to succeed on pay-per-view, and of course, mixed martial arts. Like combat sports, it's always worked, whereas sports, just typical sports, have really never been able to make that something really viable. It's like the combat sports fan has been grown up in a culture where you pay for the big match, at least in North America you do, whereas a sports fan, it's you've just been ingrained that it's always for free. So I think it would be very difficult if you were to try and change things around.
How much booking experience had Dusty had prior to coming on board here?
Well, I mean, in Florida, he certainly was working right under Eddie Graham, which is when you look at the people that worked right under him, I mean, just some of the brightest minds that have come up in the past, you know, 35 years. And I think Dusty Rhodes was certainly involved in the booking there in Florida. So coming in, he had tons of fresh ideas, but when he had first come in, business did somewhat go down in 83-84. And Jim Cornette here, he talked about the fact that Dusty, he was a genius most of the time. And I thought Jim Cornette was just so great in this documentary because he was the person that he has all these stats stored in his head, like what the gate was for this particular event, what they drew. And he seemed like in wrestling, you can sometimes get the over-exaggerated stories. And Jim Cornette was used to kind of level everything out with the facts, which sometimes are sobering for some. So I thought Jim Cornette was a great kind of companion here in this documentary to just kind of tell the story from a statistical perspective.
He always is. What type of aspect is he not great at on air?
Yeah, it's hard to say. After the first Starrcade, they also told the story here about the fact that the WWF, they flew Harley Race in and offered him $250,000 to no-show the first Starrcade event. But Harley refused to do it, stating he would never be able to look himself in the mirror and how history might have changed had this guy no-showing that first Starrcade
event.
That's
the right call. It totally is the right call.
And ended up in the WWF anyway.
Yeah.
At a later date.
I mean, come on. $250 to screw these people that you're loyal to? I mean, that's ridiculous.
And
would you accept that amount of money to not show up to, I don't know?
No, because I think...
The law?
It doesn't work out in the WWF, and I don't click with the company, and then I'm out. It's like, great, I got 250 grand and a first year of a contract, but I need to work for X amount of years after that, and I've shut myself out of the NWA.
Yeah.
Big risk, I think, associated
just
with
not
it.
To mention, like, you know, the stigma that's attached to your name afterwards in any circle.
Sure. Black Saturday was addressed. That was July the 14th, 1984, when Vince McMahon paid TBS at the time $750,000 to get that coveted 6:05 p.m. time slot to put his programming on. And it was an infamous scene where he shows up at the TBS studios, and it was pretty much a revolt from the audience, who were used to their style of wrestling with Gordon Solie at 6:05 on Saturday nights. And one of the key issues was Vince McMahon did not get exclusivity when he signed this deal. So what they did was they had Mid-South airing on Sundays on TBS. And then Saturday mornings, they gave Georgia Championship Wrestling a slot. And both outfits started outdrawing the WWF product. They would barely last. They wouldn't even last the full year before Turner paid Vince $1 million to get out of the deal. So Vince made like a nice profit of 250 grand. And there were some people here who even suggested that some of that money financed the first WrestleMania, but it was a brief period in the history of, you know, wrestling on the Superstation where it was just met with a lot of people just being turned off by the contrasting WWF product. Mm. And that, I think, gave, you know, the NWA a lot of confidence at the time that, listen, if we can get into these markets and we can just get the audience to sample us and they put both products together, they're going to choose us over them. We've got the better wrestlers. We've got the better in-ring product. But what they didn't count on was the fact of the amount of people that connected with the characters. And the booking at the time of the WWF in that 80s period was excellent. I mean, the way they peaked for WrestleManias, and I just think the NWA, they just had so much confidence that they had all these stars, and it was just a matter of expanding so that people could see them.
Do you think it was just more a matter of, you know, brand loyalty, depending on, you know, where you're from, rather than, you know, whether or not one product was actually better than the other?
I'm sure there was a lot to that. I mean, you're talking about, you know, if you've grown up just in the Northeast watching all the Madison Square Garden shows, you're familiar with this style of wrestling, it's really hard to break those habits. You might see something that's, you know, the same genre, but you're loyal to this product. You've got your habits. They run in your area, you know, once a month or wherever it is, if you're in Philadelphia or New York or there in the Northeast. And I mean, the NWA, though, when they came into the Northeast, I mean, they performed very well. There were people that, you know, in Philadelphia, they drew very well, in Baltimore. There were all these markets that the NWA was able to expand to here. The issue was, and this is addressed throughout this whole documentary, was that Dusty Rhodes, he spent a lot of money to make a lot of money.
Yes.
And that was a huge part of, you know, just getting the brand out there.
Yeah.
My favorite saying. So after WWF, they left the TBS slot at that point, and NWA regained that 605 time slot. And this was where they discussed just the hot business that the NWA was doing at the time, like regular houses of anywhere from $30,000 to $80,000 a night. The Horsemen, of course, came along at this point, and you just had a lot of characters at this point. You had your Flairs, the Horsemen by extension of that, Magnum TA, Dusty Rhodes, the Road Warriors. You had all these different acts that were really connecting at that time and doing really strong business at the time, but they always had that home base of Greensboro, North Carolina, where they held their Starrcade events from 83 up until 86. And then 1987 would be a very pivotal year, because right before that year, there was the Magnum TA car accident, where they spent a lot of time here just discussing all the potential. And it's
an interview with,
yeah, Magnum was interviewed for this, and he seemed to have a pretty good head on his shoulders in terms of just looking in perspective, because, you know, Dusty Rhodes just loved this man. He said on this thing that, you know, this guy could have been the Rock of his generation. He was going to do movies. He was going to be it for us.
Yeah.
And it's so hard to say, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, in hindsight, it's like Sting probably got that spot as that big baby face.
It's like us talking about our review from last week and how it was probably the greatest
in
review.
In a weird way, yes.
That
exactly.
was our Magnum TA.
It was our Magnum TA podcast last week. But Magnum, I think, just has a sense, you know, like, you know, there was a lot of spending at the time. Who's to say if I would have been a difference maker? I think there's no doubt he would have won that NWA title. Mm-hmm. I think for sure he would have gotten that run with the title. But instead, the car accident, it paralyzed him from the neck down, and seems to have at least regained, he gets around. I don't know his exact status at this point, you know, as we are, almost 30 years removed from that accident. Mm-hmm. Like 27 years ago, that accident happened. It was a C5 compression fracture.
How awful. I mean, you would think that, I mean, anybody, if a wrestler were to be paralyzed, it would be, you know, have to do something with him, with his profession, but just a freak car accident.
Yeah, and this was major news at the time. The newspapers, I mean, had shots of what the car looked like as he went into that post. And I'll always remember an ECW promo when Dusty Rhodes was working for ECW, and he had that program with, it was Steve Corino and Dusty Rhodes, and Corino cut a promo saying, "Dusty, we all know you were the one that cut the brakes on Magnum's car."
Oh, man.
So I guess maybe Magnum and Dusty, they were close enough that, baby, I got a line for some heat with that new guy.
There's nothing in pro wrestling that's off limits.
Nothing's off limits. One of the big issues that happened in 1987, that to me was the most pivotal year when it came to just the long-term effects here of you know, the NWA as a territory amongst itself. Was in 87, Mid-South was bleeding a lot of money, and it ended up with, you know, the Mid-South, which turned into the UWF. They were purchased by the NWA, and Jim Ross was with the UWF at the time. He was absorbed by the NWA, and the thinking was at the time that the UWF, they had set up this huge network of stations that carried Mid-South, that the NWA buying this, suddenly they would be in all these markets that they weren't in before. But they were, A, buying this company. They were going to assume whatever lease there was on their offices in Dallas, which would require a number of the executives to all move to Dallas. And suddenly it was this big expense. And much like the invasion angle of 2001, so many parallels to this purchase back in 1987, where they brought the UWF guys in. Really, it's like the remnants of it was they got Sting, because everyone else, they were not really booked very well. And Dusty admitted as such in this documentary that if he could go back and do it over, he would have done things very differently, because he just wasn't prepared at the time to execute an invasion angle.
Yeah.
And that's about it. You're laughing.
I'm just,
what?
Nothing. I just thought about Sting and how my dad had an idea at one point Because he, you know, I think he's still very enamored by the English language and how anytime, he sees something somewhat familiar in another, context, he'll, it's just funny to think about how he thinks of it. Because, you know, so we used to watch pro wrestling, like some early WCW at home, and he's like, oh, this guy's name is Sting. That's like our name. Hey, maybe you should change the name to Sting. Maybe you should put, just be the letter S, should be your first name. That way your whole name can be Sting. He said this to me as a child.
It could be S-A-I instead of W-A-I.
No, it would just be S.
S.
I would just be the letter S.
That'd be a kind of cool name.
Yeah, so then my full name would be Sting. I just thought about that. That just...
That would have been awesome.
Yeah, I know. He's weird.
I think you have a new nickname now.
No, I don't think so.
Well, in addition to the purchase of Mid-South, they also, in 1987, felt that as we're going into all these new markets, it's time to take Starrcade on the road. So they left Greensboro for the first time and took it to Chicago. And this was met with a lot of outrage from the people in Greensboro. That was our event. This is our company that we've supported all these years. And it really did affect that Greensboro city for a long, long time afterwards. And Cornette kind of summarized it, stating, Starrcade in 86 in Greensboro drew 20,000 people and $400,000 when you included closed circuit. We took it on the road in 1987. We drew 10,000 people and did a gate of $180,000. So that's just from the live event perspective. The other big issue was that as the NWA was spending and spending and spending, and one of the key points here is that with all of this talent gaining a lot of steam and you're having this competitor on your back like the WWF, you were forced into signing these guys to contracts to make sure they stayed with you. And the way they structured these deals were that they would offer you like a big six-figure contract. Say I'm signing Way here to a $400,000 contract.
Done.
So he doesn't jump to WrestlingObserver.com. I would pay you maybe, you know, in different installments as business is going.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the year, Way knocks on my door and he says, hey, motherfucker, you've only given me $150,000. So that would mean at the end of the year, I still owe you $250,000.
Yeah,
and I'd have to pay you this giant sum at the end of the year, multiply that by all the different talent that had these balloon contracts. And that was a major fucking expense at the end of each year that it was going to drain a ton of your finances. So in order to make all these payments, you were kind of earmarking that, hey, Starrcade is going to bring us X amount of net profit as a result of this. What screwed up all their estimations is that the same day that Starrcade was taking place that year, the WWF decided we're going to start a new pay-per-view called the Survivor Series, and we're going to run it the same day. And the pay-per-view companies, they were like, great, we can have Starrcade in the afternoon, Survivor Series in the evening, and they even had an idea where you could spend, it would be like $25 or something, and you get both shows.
Imagine that, $25.
Imagine that, or you could pay $55 for one and get fucked. Anyway, that's the difference between 87 and 2013. Mm-hmm. I'm still not over Battleground, apparently. So the pay-per-view companies were ecstatic. It's like, great, we're going to get Thanksgiving Day, doubleheader of wrestling. People are going to spend a ton of money on wrestling. Well, the WWF said, well, wait a minute here. If you carry Starrcade, you are not allowed to carry the Survivor Series. And on top of that, for anyone that does carry Starrcade, you're not getting WrestleMania next year either. Now, all these pay-per-view companies here, sensing their bluff being called here, are thinking about, hey, they're just coming off Hogan and Andre at WrestleMania this year. There's no way we want to lose WrestleMania next year. So of all the cable companies out there, and there were tons, like over 100, five of them carried Starrcade.
Wow.
So that just crippled them that year. And on top of it, those five were still allowed to carry WrestleMania the next year. Like, when you really think about it here, is Vince McMahon going to turn away money here? He's going to say, oh, you cable providers are not going to get WrestleMania. That's money off your table at that point. So Starrcade really suffered because of that power play by Vince McMahon. And, You know, you can call it a really dirty tactic, and many have, but at the same time, Vince McMahon really handicapped his competition there.
Yeah, that was a checkmate move.
So that was a real, real big blow in 1987. And then 1988 was the year where all of this was the NWA, they were continuing with their pay-per-views. An interesting stat way is that they ran a show in January of 1988 called the Bunkhouse Stampede, which I will assume was named by Dusty Rhodes, a pay-per-view, the Bunkhouse Stampede from Long Island, New York, which is where I would imagine a Bunkhouse Stampede to take place. That pay-per-view drew more than the domestic number for SummerSlam this year.
Wow.
How crazy is that?
That's insane.
And think about how many more homes have pay-per-view today than in 1988.
Exactly.
And that's not a buy rate. That's not a percentage. That's like number of people that bought that show.
That's unbelievable.
190,000 buys. Hmm. And the domestic number for SummerSlam right now is 186.
Wow.
That's crazy. So 1988, this is where they discussed heavily all the contract problems. And then they got into the discussion about kind of the fall of the territory, which ultimately led to the sale in November that year to Ted Turner, where he would buy the company for $9 million. And a historical note on that sale is Ric Flair, his contract was up at the same time, like just by sheer luck. His deal's up in 1988. And Ted Turner was adamant that if he's buying this company, Ric Flair has to be part of the deal. So Ric Flair had an incredible amount of leverage at this point. And it's kind of similar in a ways to TNA right now in terms of an outside buyer looking at things. And, you know, if you don't know X's and O's from wrestling here, you're probably looking and saying, well, Hulk Hogan has to be a part of the deal. I'm not buying a company without Hulk Hogan.
Mm-hmm.
And Ric Flair at the time also had numbers that would back up whatever he's being paid at the time. And the fact that they needed someone to buy them. And if Ted Turner wanted Ric Flair, that was a hell of a lot of leverage for Ric Flair. So they ended up re-signing Ric Flair for like $730,000 or something. That was, you know, in hindsight, I mean, that guy probably could have asked for anything he wanted at the time. But the company was sold to Ted Turner. And this is where they spent a lot of time discussing the fact that, you know, there were some who felt that the accountant at the time for the territory named Dave Johnson was keeping people in the dark and all of a sudden presented them with their profit and loss sheet and said, look, we're really in the hole here. Others that criticized Dusty's booking, that by 1987 it was somewhat tired at the time and he had just, you know, like any bookers, you run out of your A-list ideas. And just lots of debate about what the fall was. Dusty Rhodes he refuses to take any blame for this. As recently as an interview last week that he did promoting Battleground with Jonathan Snowden, where it was brought up, and he said, I take no responsibility for the fall of Jim Crockett Promotions.
Hmm. And he has every right to say that.
Mm-hmm.
But I really enjoyed this part of the DVD. I thought it gave a very balanced look at, you know, what everybody's opinions are about how the company ended. And for me, it was very... the most poignant part of this whole thing was to see Jim Crockett Jr. basically saying, you know, Dusty, a lot of people who don't like Dusty Rhodes will blame Dusty Rhodes, but, you know, there's really nobody you could blame but myself. I was in charge of everybody, and basically just accepting responsibility for losing his family's business like that, like a real man, I felt.
Yeah, you could definitely see that there was some dissension among the three Crocketts, mainly from David Crockett, who was just, you could tell, was pulled into this sale to Ted Turner kicking and screaming, did not want to sell it off. But I mean, the finances at the time, this thing was going to die without the support of Turner. And you would think, you know, taking yourself back to that present day or to that time period in 1988, you would think, all right, we're going to have this major media company own us who controls our television. We've got now all these resources behind us. You would think that this would be a game changer in a positive sense for Jim Crockett Promotions, where you would have tons of resources, that side of things you don't have to worry about anymore. You have all these promotional outlets to go against the WWF with. But instead, what the byproduct of it all was is that you would get various people in that Turner organization who were just thrown into the wrestling industry to oversee it without any real sufficient product knowledge. And it turned into as much a detriment as it was a positive from a financial standpoint.
Yeah.
And Jim Crockett Promotions in 1988 gets sold for $9 million. Still, extremely more than the $2.5 million with some advertising commitments that WCW got sold for in 2001 after that company was as big as any promotion was up to that point in 1998.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like...
You and I make that.
Yeah, we could have put a bit in.
Oh, imagine if you and me had bought WCW.
Oh, man.
That would have been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And you, the Battle of Sting is what I would have built up
yeah,
for.
Yeah, who gets to keep the name?
Yeah. Starcade. Sting versus Sting.
Yes.
That would have been something. That's why we don't run a promotion. So there you go. That was Jim Crockett Promotions, The Good Old Days. I've got to say, I really enjoyed the documentary. I found that they really sought out quite a lot of important figures from the time to get different perspectives, different opinions. I thought the footage was a nice addition that complemented everything really well. This never felt like something that they were just relying on a finite amount of footage. It seemed like they had a lot at their disposal to really tell the story from a visual perspective. So overall, I enjoyed the documentary.
I thought it was good. I mean, like I said before, I don't think I'm really the target audience for this type of thing. I thought, for me, it was a little hard to get into early on if you didn't already know the gist of the story and some of the players involved. I also found it, as a story, just a little too straightforward with just talking heads. And I would have liked to have seen the pace broken up with a bit more footage. But it was understandable due to, you know, the lack of rights and maybe the lack of audio and all that. Plus, it's sort of the norm with some of these straight-to-DVD wrestling documentaries. But like you, I was very impressed with the use of WWE-owned footage and photos. And I like the way they use all the subjects that they were able to find for a project like this. And no doubt, you know, something like this wasn't produced with a ton of budget. But I thought they did a very good job.
All right, so why don't I throw in this is our interview that myself and Court Bauer conducted last week with Michael Elliott, talking about the making of this documentary, how he got the Crocketts involved, and also the recent sale of all this footage that we just discussed to the WWE. All right, we are now joined by the man that is the producer of the documentary that we were chatting about earlier in the show. It's available right now at highspots.com. The Good Old Days, a look at the history of Jim Crockett Promotions. Michael Elliott joining us here on the program. How are you doing today, Michael?
Doing great, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you for joining us. And I've got to say, you got a bit of indirect promotion on Monday night when Triple H had Dusty Rhodes in the ring saying that... you know, has Dusty just been bitter all these years for just making it in Florida and that NWA thing, as Triple H brought up? And for people maybe that want to learn more about that NWA thing, it was quite the thing, as documented by you.
Right. I don't watch Monday nights anymore. I just can't stand to tune in. But, hey, any free advertisement that they want to give, that's great. And those guys are sitting on a gold mine with that footage, and they just don't know it.
Well, why don't you tell us that? Because you were, you know, for any outside WWE project, when it comes to telling putting historical features together, footage is always one of the big stumbling blocks, and you seem to just key on some great stuff that was just kind of found by accident.
Yeah, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Mid-Atlantic Gateway, but the guy that runs the website happened to be talking to a guy by the name of George Pantis, and just happened to be he was looking to sell his footage or license his footage at the time this documentary was being made, and we just were fortunate because I was going into this project knowing there was not going to be any B-roll footage. It was just going to be all pictures and interviews. But by good luck and timing, it just worked out, and George licensed this footage to us, and his story's on this too, and there's extra footage on this too that people can view and enjoy. And here's actually some news on his footage. He just sold the rights to it to WWE last
week. Oh, really?
So wow. perfect timing.
Well, they saw the documentary, clearly. Why don't we own that?
Yeah, he made the deal, but he made the deal with us first, so it worked out great.
Now, I remember talking to Michael over at High Spots, and he was saying how this is a project that was so unique because of the nature of Kickstarter, being able to not only fund and cost cover the cost of production and putting this together, but also obviously you're dealing with piracy on something like this, And, you know, it's unfortunate, but it did help make this all possible. And there is something unique about doing a Kickstarter project like that. Were you surprised at the amount of support from a fan base that's obviously long gone and not really, you know, it's a different time. I mean, it's so far removed from the late days of Mid-Atlantic back in the late 80s.
I was surprised that we actually reached the funding goal because it came down to the last 2 hours. They'll realize they were $4,000 away from reaching the goal, and somehow we just had a late surge and got it. But I'm not surprised that the fan base is, you know, still there to want to see this kind of thing because, you know, they have the Fan Fest in Charlotte every year, and I attend it every year. And, I mean, there's at least 500 or 1,000 people that travel from all over the country just to come meet these guys still. So I know that the fan base is still there. It just was reaching them because they're much older. They probably don't even know what Kickstarter is, you know.
Yeah.
No, I know it's out there.
Are you looking to do any more wrestling-oriented Kickstarter projects out of curiosity because of the success and the critical acclaim of this one?
I've been racking my brain trying to figure out. You know, I didn't know if it was the success of Hotspot's brand name that got the funding or if it was, you know, my previous work. I've done two previous documentaries prior to doing Jim Crockett. And I actually just missed a phone call before your call with Jim Cornette. Me and him were talking about doing Smoky Mountain. We would probably go to Kickstarter to try to gather the money to cover production and wrestler costs and travel and, you know, et cetera. But that's something I'm looking into, and also looking into maybe doing Georgia Championship Wrestling. And if Hotspots is wanting to work with me again, you know, they know how to contact me.
Yeah. Can you tell us, Michael, just a bit about kind of down to the wire when it came to the involvement of Jim Crockett Jr.? Obviously, he's one of the standouts that you spoke to in this documentary. Really interesting to hear his perspective because you had David, you had Jackie, and I understand Jim Crockett was not someone you were expecting as you guys were ready to pretty much send this thing out.
Right. From day one, I was under the impression that I would be lucky to get one Crockett. Period to get one involved, and I called David. He was the first one I got in touch with, and he politely said no, and I don't think that's something I want to do. And I talked to Frances, the sister, and I kind of scared her because I just found her number, and I work for television, and we have a way of finding people and don't want to be found. But out of the blue, after I talked with the sister, Jackie Crockett called me, and he said, you know, you don't call my sister ever again, and I'll give you an interview. And I was like, okay. I got him, but Jim Crockett, you know, I just had to pester David. I called David Crockett at least 6 or 7 times and had a meeting with him, and he finally broke down two weeks before the deadline, and I finally got a hold of Jim, and he said, hey, you know, come on out in Dallas, Texas. So we flew from Charlotte to Dallas with 5 days left before the deadline to have it ready to go for the premiere, and worked about 48 straight hours to finish this thing once we got back from Dallas.
Why was there such a tight deadline?
Because of the Kickstarter, and we had set to have the world premiere at the Fan Fest in Charlotte, where all the Mid-Atlantic fans would be at. So we wanted, you know, that was the perfect place to premiere it and have it for sale for the first time. And it sold extremely well. I think we sold a DVD to every fan that was there.
Yeah, and you guys had, I mean, just in terms of the Kickstarter stuff, I saw some fantastic items that you had for people that would pledge, including this great poster featuring all the guys. I mean, guys you've never seen on a poster like this in modern times, you know, just from the big stars like Ric Flair on down. It was just, you guys found a way to market this in such a creative and fun way, from the Kickstarter end to now. I mean, you could buy some of this stuff, including the DVD right now on highspots.com. And, it's just a great thing to celebrate, a great territory. Growing up in New York, I didn't have access to it, but going back and being able to jump down that rabbit hole and explore it now through this DVD, which it's a really great thing you did. You did the documentary, then you have all this bonus footage, including the entire Crockett interview, including a lot of the footage, the rough cut footage from, the individual that just sold it to WWE. I can't think of his name right now, but just an amazing amount of material over these three discs. Just, you know, Jim Cornette interview and, Baby Doll, Tully Blanchard, Rock and Roll Express, Don Carnoodle. What a comprehensive selection of people that you spoke with and had access to, which is great.
Yeah, when I first started, I didn't think it would get to be this huge of a deal, but it really turned out to be more than I ever could have imagined. And three discs, I was like, man, there's still so much stuff that I couldn't fit in a three disc that I probably could have made a fourth disc, but that would have been overkill. So there's so much more stuff here that I have that nobody will probably ever get to see.
There's
extra stories that people told, you know, nothing groundbreaking, but.
Right. And in terms of like Ole Anderson, who I know can sometimes be a bit of a curmudgeon on stuff, how was he to deal with on this?
Until you meet him and one-on-one with him, you know, you're going to have that impression that he's mean, old, and grouchy, but I think that's an act. Because he was just, you know, if you're talking to him about wrestling and you don't know what you're talking about, then he'll try to bully you and berate you. But, he was very, very, he was one of my favorites to talk to. He was very open and didn't hold anything back. And, you know, he actually called, the lady who got us in touch with him said he really enjoyed her visit. So, I'm hoping to go back down there and talk to him again about Georgia here in the near future.
Now, it seems, Michael, you know, whenever a promotion eventually goes out of business, all those what-if questions come up. And when it's specific to the NWA, you look at, you know, if only Magnum TA is one of those what-ifs. Starcade in 87, going to Chicago, and, of course, all the cable distributor problems with the WWF at the time, with the big contracts at the end. Were there any conclusions you came to yourself that maybe you went into this? And especially a lot of time was kind of spent at the end discussing, you know, where things went wrong, if it was Dusty's booking that was just not necessarily corresponding at the end, all of the money going out and not coming in and trying to go national into some markets that worked, some that didn't. What were some of your conclusions at the end, looking at this historical piece?
That's a good question. My conclusion was that just Jim Crockett just didn't. He wasn't the businessman that he should have been. You know, he wasn't paying attention when people were telling him to pay attention. He was just. I think he even says it in his entire interview. You know, I just enjoyed hanging out with the guys. You know, and then it became a business, and I just got burnt out with the business, and it just wasn't. You know, it wasn't the same anymore. I think he just kind of lost focus. And even though, you know, maybe Dusty's booking wasn't so great in 87, going in 88, but I think he just really lost focus. And he even, well, I don't want to ruin it for somebody that hasn't seen it yet, but, you know, he's very honest about what happened. But, you know, everybody has their own opinion, and I think, you know, he just lost focus and got really burnt out.
I'm curious if you reached out to Tony Schiavone during this project. Was there any contact made with him? He seems someone that has just completely distanced himself from wrestling completely. He's now involved with baseball out in Atlanta. It seems that wrestling is one of those things where for some people, when they get out of the business, it's like a switch that they just turn off and don't really want to look back at it.
We did try to get in touch with him. I don't know if it was just bad timing or he just didn't want to do it. I never actually spoke with him on the phone, but we tried because he, like you said, he does do minor league baseball, and he came through Charlotte twice during the process of putting the interview together. And I think he said it online that in between, he does basketball for the University of Georgia too, I believe, and in between seasons is the only time, between baseball and basketball, is the only time he really has that's free, and that's the only time that he would really be free to do anything. So it just didn't, I just don't think it matched up, but it just had a hard time getting in touch with him.
In terms of just any maybe misconceptions that you kind of wanted, as someone that lived through this time period, like I look at a lot of wrestling fans today that didn't grow up with the territories and through that 80s period, I think a lot of people, history is somewhat going to paint that time period as WWF being this giant national force, and then there were a bunch of offices trying to compete that ultimately went out of business. And that really, that's quite a bit of revisionist history, because there was a time when these two promotions were neck and neck, and the NWA was going into a lot of the WWF's markets in the Northeast and not only drawing, but performing extremely well in those Northeast markets at the time. And it's kind of not always the story that's been painted by the WWE when it comes to that time period and their expansion.
Right, and that's the reason why I like to do these documentaries and tell the history the way it really happened. Because WWE, you know, they own a ton of footage. They have the right to tell the history they want to the way they want to, because they have the footage. But, you know, as long as there's people out there like me and hopefully other people will come up and start doing these things. I want to continue to do them to preserve the history of the sport the way it was, it really happened. And I'm glad I got to do this Jim Crockett thing because that, I feel like they kind of got it a little wrong in the history of WCW. And, you know, they're just sitting on that footage and they could be making millions of dollars off of it. And it was just that NWA thing, like you said, Triple H said on Monday night.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you very much, Michael, for this chat, just kind of taking us a little bit of a look behind the scenes of putting together. It's a fantastic documentary. I think that a lot of people should go out of their way to check this out. It's some phenomenal footage. You pretty much didn't leave any stone unturned. I was amazed at the depth of how many different topics you were able to cover during this. But for our listeners out there who maybe haven't seen it as of yet, where can they go purchase the documentary and anything else you'd like to promote?
They can go to Highspots if they want just the Jim Crockett Promotions documentary. It's sold through Highspots.com. If you want to check out any of my previous work, you can go to elbowproductions.weebly.com and check out my other two documentaries. And maybe I can come back home when I launch my next Kickstarter and can promote that a little bit next time.
And you can pick up that documentary at highspots.com if you want to check it out. I will definitely recommend it. And now, Wei, for the second time, we are going to get to everyone's feedback to
all
this
right.
show. So let's pretend we're surprised by this
sure.
when we read it. We'll start off with Rob from Saskatoon. High Spots documentaries can be very hit or miss. Some are very good, some are quite poor. This documentary definitely falls into the very good category. The handheld footage as well as interview clips from previous interviews such as the Flair one makes this DVD 10 times better. Also, I got very little exaggeration from the wrestlers. We all know how people in the industry like to exaggerate, but I didn't sense that very often in this one. What really makes this disc worth the money is the bonus features. Not only is the entire Jim Crockett interview part of it, but extended interviews with a dozen others as well as the mini chapters on disc 2 make this one of the best bang for my buck purchases I've made in a while. Jim Crockett Promotions was obviously well before my time, so I don't know an awful lot about it, especially pre-85 or so. So I learned a ton from this documentary, which is the point. I put this one up there with the Heroes of World Class as the best promotion-based documentary not done by the WWE.
Pat from Atlanta, I was a backer of this project on Kickstarter. I was really pleased with it. I enjoyed hearing from figures like Ron Garvin, the Rock and Roll Express, and Baby Doll, who aren't likely to be invited to participate in one of WWE's documentaries. I thought Jim Crockett was very open and honest and accepted some of the criticism and blame for the promotion's failures. Besides Jim and David Crockett, you also hear from Jackie Crockett, who was not included in WWE's documentaries about Starrcade and WCW. Besides the documentary, the set features a full interview with Jim Crockett and a cool feature where everyone discusses the dusty finish. Finally, the documentary includes invaluable footage of Mid-Atlantic, which survives thanks to fan George Pantis, who had permission to film the matches. I recommend this set to those who appreciate wrestling history and to any fan of old-school NWA wrestling.
Alan Cunahan. Alan Forel, the famous Alan Forel from the Observer.
Okay.
I really enjoyed the documentary. It filled up a lot of gaps in my knowledge of the time and territory. It was well-paced, stayed on track, and was easy to follow. My favorite talking head was referee Tommy Young, who I thought came across like an incredibly nice, genuine man. Crockett Jr. must be commended for flat-out taking the blame and saying fingers shouldn't be pointed at other people. This is the complete antithesis of guys like Russo and Bischoff, who'll do anything to deflect blame off themselves. Yeah, that was interesting at the end. Because as much as people were talking about the accountant, Dusty's booking, Jim Crockett Jr. just flat out said, I was the president and I take the blame for this thing going down.
Yep.
And very few promoters are going to take that tact.
Yeah. In wrestling, it's very rare. Finally, from Mike Still, who says, I thought I'd give some... Oh, wait. He just has a bunch of questions that I think he's a little late for, but... Oh. It's insane. Here we go. Even though it was before my time, I've become a huge fan of Mid-Atlantic through WWE releases and a prolific YouTube presence. It's insane in hindsight the amount of world-class talent that made their home in the Carolinas, and even more that did some of their best work passing through the territory. So great choice, John and Wei. I recommend you check out Starrcade 83 for a future review.
All right. Well, thanks, everyone, for your feedback, and thanks for your patience after last week and the non-show. But now, providing that there aren't any errors and you're listening to this, means this one went without any problems, I'm hoping, Wei.
Yeah. And it was kind of sad because we did break a streak of 4 years of straight shows without having to miss a single week.
But I didn't need you to bring that up because that's like wrenching the knife.
Eh.
I am aware.
Whatever.
If anyone's going to take the blame, it'll be me.
No.
I made the call to skip last week's show.
It just made my life so much easier not redoing it last week.
Stop right there.
It's all my fault, Way.
No, that's ridiculous. Don't take
I'm going to Jim Crockett Jr. this.
All right, fine.
I'm not going to blame you.
Yeah, that's all your fault.
My booker. Dusty.
I'm going to dusty it.
All right.
But, no, well, that was unfortunate. But you know what? Maybe we'll build up a new streak from this point on. Episode one of 4 more years of straight shows. And this will be your last review away for a while.
Yeah, forget this streak, Way. I'm done.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm leaving for like a month.
Yeah, John's going to be gone for about 2 weeks because of this Russia trip. And so that doesn't mean that we're going to take a break.
No.
Review Away will still be around. And it'll be me here next week. And joining me for a review,
I don't know the answer to this. I'm looking forward.
It will be Dan the Mouth Lavransky.
Dan Lavransky.
Dan the Mouth Lavransky, of course, who I don't, you know, he's joined us on reviews in the past, but this will be the first time I'm doing with him by myself. And we are going to look at, this is Dan's choice, Super Brawl from 1991, the very first WCW Super Brawl, one event that Dan actually flew down to Florida to see in person. So, you know, we're sort of on an, you know, Jim Crockett Promotions WCW tip. And so, you know, this show features a lot of things like El Gigante versus Sid, Nash in the Oz outfit, and a pretty good main event with Flair versus Fujinami. So, I look forward to this a lot, especially talking to Dan about his own personal experiences many years ago at the show. So leave your feedback at the board. Watch the show. It's all up on somewhere. You'll be able to Google it and probably find it or whatever.
This is not ironic, but I will point out that next week I'm going to be in St. Petersburg, Russia, while you guys are reviewing a pay-per-view from St. Petersburg, Florida.
Wow.
What a tie-in.
That's coincidental.
It is coincidental.
Yeah.
There's nothing ironic to that at all.
No.
All right. Well, as I say goodbye to everybody for a prolonged period of time, we thank you for tuning in.
He'll be back for Pollock and Bauer and Review and Impact.
I will be later this week. That is correct. This is not the end of me for this week.
Yeah
we got to kill off my character Friday.
Yeah.
That's when it'll happen. So we will get on out of here. In the meantime, you can go to liveaudiowrestling.com. You can subscribe to all of our shows at Live Audio Wrestling. Just search for that on iTunes. You can get it on the free Stitcher app. Up right now on the show, in addition to what you've just listened to here, we've got Review a Raw from Monday night, where we spend even more time discussing the finish to Battleground. Sunday night's edition of The Law also up, featuring Jason Agnew's chat with Mickey James. Dave Meltzer saying that his conclusions on the pay-per-view are that it sucked. Plus, a lot of calls. Someone tries to defend it. The pay-per-view, that is. And our newest podcast, the newest addition to the roster, What's Next with Jason Agnew and Braden Harrington, chatting last week's edition of NXT. They're going to be doing these shows weekly, adding to the Law family of podcasts. And I'm a fan because it's not my voice on it, so I get to listen to one of our shows. So that's fun. So go check that one out. They'll be back later this week with episode number 2. And Way, you've also recently just put up the full uncut interview with Jason Agnew and Mickey James, correct?
Yeah. These two really hit it off at the Niagara Falls, at the Hammertown Comic Convention. And you'll get to see the whole thing in video.
There you go. So go check that out.
YouTube.com/TheFightNetwork.
YouTube.com/TheFightNetwork. So go check that out right now. The whole interview with Mickey James discussing her recent departure from TNA, the heel character that she had been playing and was one of the highlights of Impact every week, and an interesting story about when she first got called up to WWE and pitching the idea of the crazy girl. It was originally meant for someone else and not Trish Stratus. Find out who in this video. So go check all that out at Way0937, or you can just call him S. You should get at S on Twitter. Can you get a single letter Twitter handle?
I don't think
probably
so.
Probably not. I am John Pollock, Outlaw Radio, and we'll be back later this week. Still to come, Bauer and Pollock, the MMA Report, and Review and Impact. And let's get a song to go out here with, Way. What is, I think the only appropriate thing to end the show with is something by NWA.
Oh, wow. What a very witty.
You're stunned by my suggestion.
He's exactly.
Do you have a song?
The exact same thing John said last time we did this. What is a link between, you can think of between police and this review?
fuck, and I had a good link last week, didn't I?
Yeah, you did.
What was my link? If you give me a hint, I'll remember it.
You're saying something about the riots and how...
Oh! Well, of course, Wei. 1983, Greensboro Coliseum. Sergeant Slaughter and Don Kernodle against Ricky Steamboat and Jay Youngblood, legitimately turning away tons of fans while there was some big snowstorm going on, which I imagine there were lots of police involved, turning people away at the Greensboro Coliseum and make sure they get home safely with roads just a mess.
Well, we should thank these wonderful police officers for keeping the streets safe. But at the same time, I imagine there would be a lot of these rioters who are feeling, you know, quite oppressed by these police. And to them, I dedicate this song from the NWA.
All right, there you go.
Oh, boy.
Hopefully this one's saved. In the case of NWA versus the police department, prosecuting attorneys are MC Ren, Ice Cube, and Easy Motherfucking E. Order, order, order. Ice Cube, take the motherfucking stand. Do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help your black ass? You goddamn right. Won't you tell everybody what the fuck you gotta say? Fuck the police coming straight from the underground. A young nigga got it bad cause I'm brown. And not the other color, so police think they have the authority to kill a minority. Fuck that shit cause I ain't the one for a punk motherfucker with a badge and a gun to be beaten on. And thrown in jail, we can go toe to toe in the middle of nigga is selling narcotics. You rather see me in the pen than me and Lorenzo rolling in a benzo. Be the police out of shape, and when I finish, bring the yellow tape to take off the scene of the slaughter. Still getting swole of bread and water. I don't know if they fags or what. Search a nigga down and grabbing his nuts. And on the other hand, without a gun, they can't get none. But don't let it be a black and a white one, cause they'll slam you down to police showing out for the white cop. Ice Cube will swarm on any motherfucker in a blue uniform. Just cause I'm from the CPT, punk police are afraid of me, huh? A young nigga on the warpath, and when I finish, it's gonna be a bloodbath of cops dying in LA. Yo, Dre, I got something to say.
MC Ren, will you please give your testimony to the jury about this fucked up incident? Fuck the police, and Ren said it with authority. Because the niggas on the street is a majority of gang. It's with whoever I'm stepping. And a motherfucking weapon is kept in a stash spot for the so-called law. Wishing Ren was a nigga that they never saw. Lights start flashing behind me. But they're scared of a nigga, so they mace me to blind me. But that shit don't work, I just laugh. Because it gives them a hint not to step in my path. But police, I'm saying, fuck you, punk. Read my rights and shit. It's